Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about something like about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. And you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people.
Too many times.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles, the kid no one would pick, was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your... your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a chap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come. We'll be right back. All right.
Today, we sort of free-fall today. The working title we have today on Here's My House is Floor College, and we'll be talking about floor construction and floating floors and exactly what is a floating floor. Well, floating floors typically belong to floating buildings or houses or dwellings, whatever you want to call it. So we'll go through that. We have program notes that we'll go over that you can see them on our Blog Talk Radio scrolling marquee page if you're online, which if you're listening to me, you're online. And then we got some videos, not our videos, but videos that you might want to follow on our Facebook page, which is It's My House TV, just It's My House TV. And it's not our videos, but I posted them up there, dealing with floor construction. So it's about at least two videos on there talking about floor construction. And then, we got some text information that you guys sent, so we're going to share that because that's feedback coming from our listeners here on It's My House. So we're going to play the Rural Energy Foundation, Solar Now, and then we're going to take a quick phone call at 732 and then get into Floor College, floor construction. What we decided to do is deconstruct, the book that I mentioned some time ago, The First 20 Hours, How You Can Learn Anything, a Language, or Even Building a House. And we're talking about tiny houses in that case. The book, The First 20 Hours, tells you basically if you can learn the basics of anything within 20 hours. Now, you won't be world class, you won't be a master, but you'll know enough to self-correct. So that's one of the books that we use. So I had to say, you know what, let's just break this house down in the chunks, small chunks. So we're starting off with the floors, the foundation and the floors. So therefore, I call it Floor College. And we're going to be talking about floor construction and floating floors. So we'll be going to 723 right after this.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this, because it remains the property of the clients. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness, because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits, which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is, these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us, we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working. And then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tons of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from Solar Now retailers to get their businesses going.
Solar Now is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technicians, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Of course, it's cold. The beer tastes better. And so I get more customers.
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be, super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that sometimes you're right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you're driving.
That is true.
Down a super highway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build little shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. I, coming along, I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them. And there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and beg, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
All right. And that's one of the projects that we shall be working on and corresponding with the title of today's podcast, which is Miles TV. And then I believe I have two videos on it that will study that, because they're about 15 minutes, 160 minutes, 22 minutes. That's what will be
Hello? I can't hear you guys at all right now. I've been going in and out for a bit, but I got a couple good questions. Plus, also, I love the topic I've been talking about for the past couple minutes. Yeah, I think I lost you guys. I know it ain't me. I know my thing's solid. If I call back, just make sure you answer. They've got to be on your end. I love the show, and I got a couple questions, man. I need help with a flooring project. And also, like I said, I like what you guys are talking about.
Also tonight, the incredible transformation and the Buffalo Strong spirit that made it all happen. 7 Eyewitness News reporter Taylor Epps shows us how a young lady has completed her very own renovation project.
11-year-old Lauren Nelson had big plans for her summer.
I thought it was going to be...
I heard a commercial there for a minute.
Okay, can you hear me now?
I can hear you well.
All right, yeah, I had to call in on my cell phone. I don't know, my landline's tripping. Okay,
yeah,
so
question? I don't know what it screwed with, but it got a little wacky here for a minute.
Okay, so what's your question?
All right, well, I got a couple things, if you don't mind, if you got the time. The reason why I called in originally is I'm a boiler guy.
Uh-huh.
I took an old American Standard boiler out of one of those old soot monsters.
Okay.
Out of a old lady's basement, and the pad that it was on, because they used to always have concrete pads under all the boilers. I don't know if they do that where you're from, but up here in Jersey, that's what they do. And the thing was cracked probably since it was put in the 60s. They might have cracked it dropping a boiler on there. I mean, the dirt was pushing up through the cracks to the point where it was spreading and making a boiler uneven and everything. And I usually, when I put down a new boiler, so I wanted to get a concrete guy to come in there and just you know, float a good patch for it and drop a new boiler. And she says she wants it high, 4 inches, the way they were. So I went and bought a bunch of, you know, 4x12 block for the legs. And then, you know, try to build a whole square out of it, build a pad. And she said, no, I want it the way that it used to be. I want it on a pad. And it's so cracked and the dirt so close. I mean, some of the concrete right around the pad is only about an inch thick. And I don't know how to drop, like, what's the best concrete to use when you're on straight dirt. Like, it's not stone on the straight dirt.
I have no idea when it comes to that question. None at all. All I can do is recommend to talk to, I mean, they probably got some, forums on Facebook, and I'm sure there's several YouTube channels where you can get in contact with those, you know, people that make those videos and they can answer their question.
Yeah, well, this just came up yesterday, and then I said, you know, I saw the show. I was like, all right, shit, well, the guy will tell me about flooring.
Now, the flooring the floors we're talking about is for people that are interested in building tiny houses. Now, we're talking about houses that are, or structures,
because floating
less than 400 square feet.
Floating cement.
Well, no, when I say, and I'm glad you asked that question, when I say floating floors, okay.
Now I see what you're doing. You're building on plywood and on. Yeah, I understand what you're doing.
All right. Well, it's not permanent. I'll give you an example. If you take any let's take a tiny house. No, let's take a shed. Okay, just a shed that nobody plans on living in. So if you take a shed and you build it on a permanent foundation, which a concrete slab, which once you put it on that concrete slab, you cannot move it. That shed's no longer movable. All right.
Not yet.
Then once that happens, then typically here in the United States, that the local tax assessor is going to increase your taxes based on any permanent structure that's on the land. Right.
Yeah. Real quick, I'm gonna say this as fast as humanly possible.
Right.
Because I don't want to interrupt you too much, but I had built a halfway decent garage at my mom's house, and they said because it was a solid floor on a solid slab, and because it was below the sewer line, I know I'm above the below the sewer line. So, well, you can put a bathroom, so we got to add that as a housing structure. And they went and added like $900 a year to her property taxes. Her property taxes are only $2,800.
Now, what part of the country is that in?
Yeah, I was in Pennsylvania.
I mean, what city in Pennsylvania?
Bath.
Huh?
Bath.
Sure, do you know the population of that city?
Oh, Bath is actually an unincorporated part of another town, so I'd probably say about maybe 3,000-4,000.
All right, but they increased their property taxes based on that, though.
Yeah, because they said that could, because even though it's not a living structure now, it could be.
Right.
And they screwed
that's what we're talking about. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, floating. So floating is a structure that is not permanently attached
like
to the land.
On skids?
It can be on skids. It can be on blocks, which you can hide that with a skirt around it. Wheels, but it's something that's not permanently attached. So it can be land. It can be on a deck, you know, where you can, or you can you can construct it, or you can deconstruct it. But it's not a permanent structure. In certain areas, if you don't have, you know, certain amenities within it, you know, is not considered a so-called house. The word house, at least as far as I'm concerned, the word house is like regulated. Now, generally speaking, there are 19,000 municipalities in the United States. So, and the 86% of the population lives on only 5% of the land mass. And yeah, out of that 47% of the United States live in towns that have a population of 5,000 people or less. So the information that I'm giving is for people that basically live in or thinking about moving to a town that has a population of 5,000 people or less. The smaller the town, in my opinion, if you find a town that's got like 1,000 people or less, those are the best places to do what I'm talking about right now. For instance, you're not going to do this.
I don't know where you're from, but I'm going to Tennessee because that's just good, clean living.
Right. I'm glad you picked it up. What I'm talking about, you're not going to be able to do in Nashville or Memphis. However, if you're in a place like Newport, Tennessee,
I'm going to more.
You can do what I'm talking about.
Okay. I'm going about 14 miles north of Morristown.
Okay, I've heard of Morristown. What I know about legally in Tennessee so far is Newport. In Newport, there are areas of Newport, Tennessee, where you can build a structure that is off the grid, and you're legally off the grid. The mayor knows, the city council knows. That's what you can do right now today in Newport, Tennessee. You can build a structure that what I would call a floating house. You know, floor, which is a part of the house, just means, you know, it's not a permanent structure. However, if you go to Memphis, Tennessee, or Nashville, Tennessee, where the population is dramatically larger, you're not going to be able to do what I'm talking about. However,
that's when you get more politics.
My whole thing is, most people who, like I say, 86% of the population occupies only 5% of the land mass. So I'm talking to the people that are looking outside of that 5% of the land mass. 95% of the land mass in the United States is rural, and 47% of the population lives rural, and that's almost half the people in the United States. You know, they live in these little small towns. So what I talk about basically is it can be done in those towns. But if you want to live in New York, Chicago, Dallas, Fort Worth, Orlando, those places, the information I'm giving out here today and most days, you're not going to be able to do. And I was born in Washington, D.C., lived in Washington, partially raised in D.C. because I lived in some other places too. But so I'm an urban guy that discovered, you know what, if I want more freedom and want more financial power, it's better for me to go out in a rural area. For instance, in Washington, D.C., in the metro area, you have people that are earning $40,000 or $50,000 a year income, and they're renting rooms for $500, $600, $700, $800 a month. Whereas, I'll give you an example, I bought 10 acres of land in Texas for $2,000.
Not a bad deal.
So, and there are plenty of places like that all throughout the United States.
I was raised by city people, but I lived most of my, you know, for about 10 years I lived in Kentucky in Fort Lick Holler, and I loved it. That's most free I ever been in my entire life. Not a lot of opportunities, but a lot of damn freedom. And the nicest people you'll ever meet in your entire life.
Right.
You know, you may sacrifice a couple of conveniences that people have in urban areas and cities, but it makes up for it in your mental health and just being around good people just helps. It's the best life that you'll ever live.
I agree with you. What you're praying for in the New York cities, the St. Louis's, the Seattle, Washington's, the San Diego, California, what you're praying for is the comfort and conveniences of what those towns provide. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, you got, like in D.C., got the subway, you got a bus line, you can walk to your job maybe or take the bike. But you're paying for that, and it's getting to be really expensive.
I'm gonna go as far as to say this: you're paying for it with your soul, because as those conveniences don't give you happiness, usually it's struggle and frustration 99.9% of the time. But when you're living in a place with good people and a good life, you're just a happier person. I believe you benefit from that. Not only you're not going to benefit financially being in an area that you can't get everything in a couple seconds, but you're going to benefit spiritually because you're going to feel.
I think you can benefit financially from all right, for instance, like now you have a lot of people that telecommute, so you don't have to go into a brick and not with all jobs. But with many jobs now or businesses, people can telecommute. Now, for people
that's actually an issue I wanted to talk to you about, because a lot of these people that don't have the motive or the belief system as people in rural areas,
right.
They're going out there now to save a couple dollars, but they're bringing the horse shit with them. I don't like that too much.
Right. It's a different situation for everybody. It's different for everybody, but it, like I say, and I'm just using the D.C. metro area, which you're trying to make into a miniature Manhattan, New York. You can earn $40,000 or $50,000 a year, but your budget will allow you to rent a room. That's if you want to sort of be sustainable and save something out of your paycheck.
You want to share a bathroom.
Yeah, and you know what? I know of people that are making $50,000 a year in the D.C. area. They're renting a room in a house, and they got to share a bathroom. That's common in New York City as well, and probably Los Angeles, California as well.
If you make that money in West Virginia or Kentucky, You own property.
That's what I've told people that live in the DMV. I say, look, if I were you, okay, all right, you work in D.C., all right, and D.C.'s got a lot of, I mean, you got Amtrak, you got Greyhound, you got a lot of transportation, people carpool. If I were you, I would select a community within an hour to an hour and a half radius of D.C., and live in that place.
You go to Nova? I got a buddy living in Nova, North Virginia. He's paying $680 a year property taxes on a house that he only spent $111,000 on. It's a 4-bedroom, 3-bath.
And how much you say the property taxes were?
$680-something a year.
That's cheap for that area. Extremely cheap.
There ain't nobody out there. Where he's at, there's nobody there. They got a gas station, and that's it. They don't even got a post office nor a police department.
Okay.
State.
You know what part of Virginia he's in now? You said Northern Virginia. Well, what part of Northern Virginia?
I'd have to contact him and figure it out.
Right, because now I know West Virginia, there's quite a few. In D.C., I don't know what the new statistic is, but during the Marion Barry years, there were 700,000 people that worked in D.C. but didn't live in D.C. All right. And that's more people than actually live in the city.
Oh, yeah.
But, they come from Front World, Virginia. They come from West Virginia because at the time, at least when Barry was in there, you can go to West Virginia and buy a house for $12,000.
West Virginia is a good, that's a good place to live too, if you get, as long as you get into the right neighborhood. The problem is, and you know, I don't want to get into, you know, into the dynamics of humanity, but a lot of places that I've been, especially like Kentucky, you start to get it. Everybody's a little downtrodden, and you know, the ones who are screwing up are fucked. Pardon my French. And so it starts to become like a bad area with like drugs and crime, which, I mean, 99 points. We were, you know, I was listening to you guys talking, and it ain't about race, because 90% of the crime coming from those areas in West Virginia and Northern Kentucky are all just white, toothless guys on meth.
Yeah, you got that. Even
bitches are ballsy.
Right. When I was up in Rutland, Vermont. I understand there's a serious meth epidemic up there. I didn't see it, but people that lived up there told me about it. But yeah, for the sake of this conversation, my solution is go rural. All right, you can still, because I mean, you got people. I mean, I know people that live in Pittsburgh. His 9-to-5 is in Boston, so he flies to Boston during the week and he flies home on weekends. In D.C., you got people that take the Amtrak, the MARC train. They might live in Richmond, Virginia. That's 90 miles south. They might live in Philadelphia.
Biden did that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Biden, he was just out of Delaware. So you have a lot of people that live in Delaware that commute to D.C. 5 days a week. You have people that live in Philadelphia that commute to D.C. 5 days a week, or some stay in D.C. during the week, go back to Philly on the weekend, or some take, you know, if they don't commute by MARC train or Amtrak, they'll fly in to National and then drop them on the subway. D.C.'s got commuters Monday through Friday. They come from as far north as Boston to D.C., and I know Richmond, Virginia, which is only 90 miles. So you have a lot of people. So I just tell people, if you live in D.C. or New York City or any expensive metro area, all right, give yourself a 90-mile radius of that city and just look for communities where you can buy inexpensive housing.
I say, listen, if you're going to get a job, put in a commute and you'll live free and happy. Just put in a little bit money for a commute. People go, well, I have enough money to spend. I work in New York City. I have this much money to spend living here. Well, look about the money that it would take for you to commute and see what you'll get. It'll be 1,000 times better, 1,000 times bigger, and you'll be 1,000 times happier. You just got a budget for the commute. That's it.
Right, and
I'd rather spend 2 hours a day after an 8-hour, you know, an hour before work and an hour after work on an 8-hour day commuting to not have to live on the Upper West Side.
Yeah, I agree. I've got a friend of mine. He lives in.
I don't know who the fella you were talking to earlier when I thought we were off the line. Talking about how black people rent used to be able to build checks.
Oh, that was an audio I played. That wasn't me.
Oh, okay.
That was an audio I played.
I thought that was you live talking.
No, that wasn't me. That's an audio I had.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, but I don't believe it's a racial thing either, because like I said, I lived in Forklift Holler in Kentucky, which is one of the most downtrodden neighborhoods of Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
It's a shithole, pardon my French. But
right.
We finally had some contractors come in and started putting people's houses together, right? And they were doing it for pennies on the dollar. And even though all white guys, I'm a white fella myself, and they wouldn't allow that. Politicians wanted only union work had to be done, so this way we can pass the city codes. And that's why I hate unions to this day, because they force themselves to make people spend way more money than they need to spend just to live. And I do believe those shacks on the sides of the river, like you know, that was in that that little piece that you put out.
Right.
They ain't the greatest shacks in the world. But damn if they won't fucking, if they won't, you got a place to live, right?
Let me ask you something. Now, you say you're white.
Yeah, white fella.
Okay, I'm glad. I'm glad you called in. You, all right, you grew up what in, what, Kentucky, you say? Or you've been through there, at least?
I grew up in New Jersey. Lived in Kentucky for quite a long time, though.
But you've been to Kentucky?
Oh, hell yeah.
All right.
Best place
Kentucky
ever
is in,
life.
Yeah, part of the state, and I don't know if all of the state, I know where West Virginia is in Appalachia. Could you share with us, because for some reason, some people think all white folks are rich. So could you explain, or the people that live in Appalachia, what their conditions look like?
I got to be honest with you, probably the most depressing place I've ever been in my entire life. I grew up in Irvington, New Jersey, which is, I'm going to say probably the third worst city in New Jersey. You know, screw the people of Patterson. It's Newark, Camden, and Irvington. And I see people suffer, but I don't see them stuck. Like, people in Irvington are fine to the point where they can find more money. There's money coming through. There's places to panhandle. There's things to do. There's things to rob. Even if you want to go as far as to say, at least you could rob something. But people in the hollers in West Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee, there ain't even a damn thing they can steal. They're screwed. Somehow they still hold God in their heart. I don't know how they do it. They're tougher than any son of a bitch I ever met in my life, and I love them for that. But yeah, they go through a hell, man.
Well, you mentioned that word holler. The last time I heard that word, I was physically in West Virginia myself about 6 or 7 years ago. Well, yeah, I've been through Appalachia a few times, and it matter of fact, because I'm black, so I. There was one guy that I met at the destination I met. Everybody else is white. My transportation there. I've been through Western Pennsylvania, several times in West Virginia, have been to Kentucky, Western Maryland. Appalachia has a lot of poor people. And they're not black. There's some black. But there's a lot of poor white people that are struggling.
It's mostly white, but I've met people down there never seen a dollar bill a day in their life. 25 years old, never actually held a piece of paper money a day in their life. You believe that?
Yeah, I haven't heard of that one, but anything's believable.
Oh,
I guess
I've met them. When I went down there, I went down there with all earnesty. And I care about communities, and when I drove, I don't know if you've ever driven up a holler. When you drive in, if you don't have good intentions, you're probably not going to make it out. I went in there with good intentions. I helped.
Yeah, when
I
was in West Virginia, I had good social capital. I'll just put it that way. I had an absolute blast, but I had good social capital going. I stayed up there for about 4 days or so. The last time I was up there, it was an organization that they make solar lights, among other things, electric cars or cars that run off of vegetable oil. So I had good social capital going in. I didn't have any problems at all, you know, up through those hollers in West Virginia, you know, this part of West Virginia that I was in.
So you came in with good intentions. Or I do love the way that you said social capital, and I'm going to steal that if you don't mind.
Oh, no,
that's a great word. That's a great word.
Well, you know, it first thing I had interviewed one of the people right here on this podcast. He's been on here probably twice. And then he came from a recommendation from somebody else that was in Michigan. We were talking about time banking originally. So we chopped it up on the phone, and I just said, you know what, I'm booking a ticket. And it took me a couple of days to get there because I didn't fly in. And then they picked, you know, I remember I was in Pittsburgh because I went to Florida where I started off and got to D.C. Then from D.C. I had to go to Pittsburgh. And from Pittsburgh I had to take a bus. And I didn't see anybody black but me, but I didn't have not one ounce, no problems at all. When I got to, like I said, I had an absolute blast when I got to the destination and learned a lot about solar energy and sustainable living while I was in West Virginia. So now, that's what I'm telling some of these people that live in the D.C. area. I'm saying, look, consider a 90-mile radius, at bare minimum a 90-mile radius of D.C., where you're working in D.C., and look at West Virginia, Western Maryland, and parts of Southern Pennsylvania, where you can find, you know, instead of renting a room for $600, $700, $800 a month, and some pay more than that. You know, if you got a studio apartment, you can pay $2,000 a month.
Oh, shit. They're out of their fucking mind over here.
Well, exactly. So
I got a buddy who works in Johnson City, Tennessee.
Uh-huh.
And he told me about what he paid for his house. I said, why would you pay $387,000 for a house when you can live 45 minutes away and get a house for $35,000 with almost no property taxes compared to what you're paying? But you don't like commuting? And you could also do something for a community that needs the money. Johnson City doesn't need the money.
Well, you know what? Here's, from my point of view, it's not only a problem here in the United States, but it's global, particularly in your larger cities. You have a lot of urbanites, and I used to be one of them. You have a lot of urbanites that are addicted, just like a meth head, just like a crackhead. They are addicted to the comfort and conveniences of city life. They can walk to work. They can take their bike to work.
They
can go grocery shopping. They can go to Whole Foods. Yeah, they can go to work.
But all that costs money.
I
pay $3,200 a month for a two-bedroom, but I got a Starbucks at the bottom floor of my building. That's how convenient it is. I go, well, why don't you just go out and live in the country and make your own awesome coffee? You can make your own coffee.
Exactly, yeah, because you go to... I got a friend of mine. He goes to Starbucks 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, if not seven. And, you know, Starbucks – now, I like Starbucks like anybody else, but the only time I go to Starbucks for the last 2 years is when I'm on a road trip. All right, I'll drop $5 on a venti. But I've
never been to a Starbucks.
I haven't done that in 3 years.
I've traveled this whole country. I was a stand-up comedian for years. I travel this whole country. That's why I don't like urban areas. I love rural areas because I'm never happy. Like the best coffee you'll ever get is at a diner ran by a woman who just wants to make sure, and she calls you honey child. That's the best thing ever. If I go into a Starbucks, nobody's ever called me honey child. But when my ass is like 35 minutes outside of Savannah, Georgia, and it's beautiful, and I don't mean to make it about race, but this beautiful big old black woman comes out, and she goes, how you doing, honey child? What can I get you? And it's the best coffee I ever had in my life. Maybe not because of the coffee. Maybe because she made me smile right before I took my first sip.
And the coffee doesn't cost $5 either. You're not going to pay $5 a year because that's what I – but I haven't been to Starbucks in at least 3 years.
Even though it doesn't say it on the menu, it's free refills. She cares about you. And those are my favorite people on the planet.
You don't get that at Starbucks, free refills. Well, that's why I throw out the statistics. Like, say, there are 19,500 towns in the United States. Only 10 of them have a population of a million or more people. And then I would say, let's see, 19,500, you know, man, lop off the first, 2,000 towns, 2,000 to 3,000 towns in the United States. Live in the that's if you want to get ahead of the game. I can't tell grown folks where to live.
Well, I'm just saying for the people
that are living in rooms in D.C., Chicago, Boston, Seattle, Los Angeles, California, those places, Miami, even Orlando, Florida, for the people who are renting rooms, like I said, I got a friend of mine in Baltimore. He's paying $700 a month rent. He's facing eviction. Good things the courts are backed up right now. But I said, man, for that $700, I would go to Home Depot, Lowe's, or Menards. I would go into a hardware store and buy me some lump, what I needed, and find you a friend where you got some social capital and build you a tiny house in their backyard.
Hell yeah. Put yourself a little something together. Put yourself a little something together and get the hell
now,
out of
now, that's not for everybody. Yeah. Well, that's not for everybody, I understand that.
Well, I think that's why me and you are, and I'm gonna say this as an insult to everybody that doesn't think like us, I think that's why me and you are smarter than the average bear. Because we see the importance of freedom and self-reliance and the importance of freedom, truth be told, is one of the greatest things, you know, of all time. You know, freedom is, you know, that was given to us. I don't care about political shit. It's not my business. But as a Christian, I believe we are granted freedom by our Lord and Savior. And to have that and to feel that freedom and to step out every day and not have to take an elevator down, not have to, you know, go, well, I got to work I got to work a little more overtime this week because I need a new dishwasher. Wash your dishes, dude. Like, what is wrong with you? You can't wash your dishes have been clean for hundreds of years. But you got to buy a machine to do it now? Wash your dishes and shut up. Act like a person. Go outside and play baseball. Hang out with your buddies. Go down to the bar. Even if you don't drink, go down and have a Coke on ice and play shuffleboard with the local fucking jackasses. Those are good guys.
Right.
It's nice to have a bit of community.
Well, when my clothes dryer went out, I didn't replace it. I put clothes on the clothesline, so I let nature dry my clothes.
Well, I was talking about a dishwasher. You wash your clothes in the dishwasher?
No. I got a washing machine, but the clothes dryer. I had a clothes dryer.
Yeah, no. Well, no.
And when that stopped working, I didn't replace it. I go out back, and I got a clothesline, and I put the clothes on the clothesline and let nature do it.
I think we lost our sense of community to where you should be around people. People in D.C. that are spending $3,200 a month for a studio, they don't have a sense of community. They don't know their neighbors. They live in a building with, I'm going to say, what, 9 stories, 10 apartments, 90 apartments. They don't know anybody in that place. Now, when you go to Fort Lick, Kentucky, or any place like, you know, similar to that, you know every single person in the town. You know the cop. Even when you screw up and you get a little bit drunk and you punch the mailman, and they go, all right, well, don't do that again, dude, but, you know, we like you, so we're going to let this go this one time. there's a bit of community in that that nobody seems to acknowledge because they're so self-centered. And I hate the fact that everybody's so self-centered when we're all supposed to be here together. This is a shit.
Well, you bring up a good point.
In a
lot of your little small towns, the social, I give a good example. In a place like Boston, D.C., Chicago, L.A., Orlando, where you have a social services office. Now, I'm not knocking anybody on social services or anything like that. But typically people that go to social services are socially bankrupt. They don't have enough social capital to make ends meet. Whereas in a small town,
I like the term social capital, and I will be using
that. Yeah, there's a lot of social capital that exists. I was on a call last night with a couple of people, and this one gentleman, and then somebody this morning. I think they have a community of just 12 people, but they've bought, I think collectively, like over 200 acres of land. You know, collectively.
They're taking good care of each other.
Right. See, there you go. Because they're talking about growing food and their social care. We're just talking about 12 people, you know,
That's what it is. I mean, listen, it's not sustainable to just have these tiny communities, but they are beneficial. Like,
right.
Like me, I'm a boiler guy. I can sweat and solder and do anything heating-wise that I need to do. And then maybe there's a guy who knows how to fix cars, and maybe there's somebody who knows how to I'm not going to go as far as to say stitch clothes because I can just buy those. But
people out here that know like I know somebody – see, I talked to her offline yesterday, I think, that she used to call in here. She makes quilts. You know, and if you look inside of the Amish communities within the United States, there are people that make bedding. They make quilts and other, you know, bedding.
Very self-sufficient people.
Right. You know, so it's – oh, but matter of fact, I talked about it earlier this week or last week, a place, and this is just one community like this, Yoder, Kansas. Yoder, Kansas is an Amish Mennonite community of 163 people.
I didn't know they had Mennonites out there.
Yeah, if you look up Yoder, Kansas, and you look up, you know, they have, you just look at their businesses that they have. But it's a sustainable town, and there are other communities out here just like Yoder, Kansas.
Well, look at Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Yep, Amish country.
It's all horse and buggy. They do a little bit of money through tourism, but they take care of themselves.
They do.
Now I don't believe in segregating, because I believe we should all it should just be good people, not just your beliefs. It should be just good people, and that's what I love about you know, me being a white guy and you being a black fella. You know, I that's what I love the most about like Kentucky. Kentucky was the least racist place I've ever been in my entire life. Now there was zero. And I was blown away. I was literally brought to tears when you see like old white guys with cowboy hats on, and they're like, "This is my wife," and it's big old black broad. I'm like, "You guys are awesome. Nobody's worried about racism. It's only in the news and what they do. The true heart of this country does not give a shit. The true heart of this country wants you to
You know what? There's a documentary on YouTube that people want to check out that'll reflect what you're saying right now. What's the name of that documentary? I think it's titled Banging in Little Rock. Banging in Little Rock. I think that's it.
Of course I do.
And that's a pretty interesting part of that video illustrates what you're talking about.
Well, banging in Little Rock was one of the most dangerous, one of the most scariest things I've ever seen in my entire life.
That documentary I'm talking about came to race relations. Race didn't play a factor among people in that documentary, though.
They didn't give a damn.
Exactly. They didn't give a damn.
I'm gonna be, you know, as a born Northerner, but as a wannabe Southerner, I do believe the South is probably the nicest place on this entire planet. I'm gonna go as far as to say that the South is the least hateful place on this planet. They just love everybody. They don't give a hell where, you know, give a damn where you're from, what you do. Long as you're good to them, long as they're, you know, just show, you know, be respectful, be good. You can be rude to a black drug dealer in College Park, Atlanta, or be rude to a white racist in Andalusia, Alabama, and they'll both treat you with respect.
Okay, now let's say you're correct generally speaking, but and people, y'all can chime in 619-768-2945. I'm opening up the phone line to see the others in a moment. Give me your feedback on this is a case that happened this year, like the Ahmaud Arbery case, because that happened in the South.
You want my input on it?
Yeah.
All right, well, Ahmaud Arbery, there is 95 different videos going out. Some of them from, you know, from the same angle or whatever. It shows him, like, stealing from and hunting down, you know, new construction sites. The guy's a criminal, no doubt about it. But is it your job to jump to chase the guy down with a pickup truck and then get mad when you get killed? Well, that's, you took that risk. You took the fucking risk. I don't think Ahmaud Arbery was a good guy. I think he was probably, you know, he was the son of a gun at best, but also not your job. If you're going to be a Republican, which I'm not, I'm a libertarian, I believe there should be no goddamn police, and I do believe we should be able to go after people. But you voted Republican, talk to the police about it. Now, when the guy defended himself, he defended himself. He tried to grab the gun. I don't blame him for doing that either. I don't like him for you know, scouting houses and being the son of a gun, but I don't blame him for grabbing that gun either. Nor do I blame
you. You talking about Arbery?
Yeah, that's what we're talking about, right?
Okay.
Yeah, I don't blame him either. I don't blame either side, to be honest with you, because the guys had, you know, I don't think they had the right to go chasing them down.
Yeah.
I think they should have, well, you know what? Yeah, you know what? I apologize. Yeah, no, I do think they had the right to do that. I do believe that when guy pulled out the shotgun, I do believe that Ahmaud Arbery had all the right in the world to grab that gun. And I do believe that the guy had all the right in the world to shoot him. I believe everybody was right on all sides. No ifs, ands, or buts. I mean, you fuck around, you're going to find out. Ahmaud Arbery was not a good guy. He was not it wasn't like, you know, the picture that they show up, you know, that they put on the news, that he was this awesome, awesome kid who was just trying to be a physicist or a rapper or whatever they were saying.
Uh-huh.
But also, don't chase things down if you ain't ready to get your gun grabbed. And also, don't grab guns if you ain't ready to get shot. I think that was just a kind of odd thing that happens sometimes in this world. And I'm sorry, that, you know, I hate the fact that the man died. 30 years is right for anything of that sort. A couple of years.
Well, they gave him life and They threw some years on top of the life. Well, that was for Travis, not Tevin.
They'll get out.
You think so?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you got right here, the Simpson. You are Travis, which was the youngest guy.
Oh, no, he'll do about I'm going to say 5 to 10, and he'll be out. Because they're going to
on a life sentence?
The trial. What's that?
On a life sentence, he got life. All right, him and his father got life plus some years on top of that. He got 30 some years.
Yeah, no, they're gonna appeal it, and they're gonna end up dropping it to involuntary manslaughter or some weird shit like that. And he'll have to do like 12 maybe. I would say he'd probably be out in about 12.
Well, they got an appeal. I mean, I'm sure they will file an appeal, so that'll be interesting to check out.
The appeal's already being done, but I think they should wait. If I'm going to be, I'm going to be truly honest, not from a standpoint of what I care, because I don't. But if they get a, as soon as we have, a Republican president, then they'll go for the appeal. If they're smart, they'll wait. Wait for a Republican president. Get him to push the Supreme Court to give him give him that appeal. Drop it down. Hit him with like a involuntary 12 years. Or he's already been in there for so many. He's only got 3 more to go. Like he'll be out.
Now you got 3 of them in there though. You got Travis McMichael. You got his dad in there, and then you got the other guy with the least amount of time, Roddy Bryant, something like that.
Oh yeah,
he got 30 something years.
Well, they'll be up. Mark, my
all right, we'll be interesting to look at. All right, hold on, buddy. Let me go to the next caller here. 314, your mic is open.
Well, I was going to call about the question he had when he first called in, but if you're talking about this Arbery case, I agree with the gentleman. The case was going to be retried, appeal. Whoever the hell heard of getting life for a hate crime? That's the federal government with Garland posturing, trying to get black votes for Joe Biden, I guess. And, of course, now we talk about the state of Georgia, but there in Akron, Ohio, you had 3 black males beat to death a white male this year within the last month or so. So is that a hate crime? They beat him to death on their playground to the school that LeBron James, Promise School, that LeBron James is sponsoring. So is that a hate crime? And when you have all the blacks that shot by other blacks, in Chicago in a year's time, like 4,666. Well, is that a hate crime? He's going to get out. But I'm going to ask the gentleman, what kind of problem will you have with your slab, sir?
Well, do you mind if I respond to that? Because I'd really like to. I don't think we should be comparing what somebody did should be, somebody else should be responsible for that. Black on white crimes and white on black crimes, they're not supposed to be compared. We're not supposed to be going, well, this guy got this, so this guy's got to get this. We should be looking at it all as humans. Now, as a Christian, I understand that the judicial system doesn't look at things like that, but that's the way I look at things. And I don't hope that somebody gets overcharged or undercharged whatsoever. I believe that, I just hope everybody gets charged accordingly to what the law says. You know what I mean?
Well, I agree with you on part of that, but nowadays you see an attack on white males. I give you an example, and I gave you this story of this case.
My black girlfriend punched me in the face 16 weeks ago.
Well,
But
listen to what I got to say. In Normandy, Missouri, which is right outside of St. Louis, west of St. Louis, hardly no place.
Worst city in America.
You had a mayor, black mayor, who made a public statement that he was going to fire all the whites because now Normandy is black, all the white city workers. It's in the papers.
I'm saying that
when blacks do things against whites, you get nowhere near the type of attention as you do when it's the other way around, especially by the news.
Well, see, I learned something new, sir. That has nothing to do with the black community or the white community. That has to do with the news outlets. We need to start attacking the news outlets for not covering certain things.
Well, yeah, it does have to do something with the black community because I know Ferguson very well, and I am black. Now, hang on, let me say what I got to say. Because in the things that went on in Ferguson, see, blacks left the city of St. Louis in areas like Walnut Park, Penrose Park, DeVille, and they moved away from crime to the suburbs, which is right on the outskirts of the city of St. Louis, to get away from the crime. Well, as this was back in the 70s. Well, in 2014, when you started having these riots and that, well, these poor people, I'm sorry to say, they lost out because they had to walk away from home values, get away from the riot-type activity that's there today. Now, that's a fact.
I mean, if you look at the problem you're going to have
with your slap.
Sorry.
He was calling about the slap.
He wanted to answer that question.
Well, no, I was just going to make the reference to, like, if you look at Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and Easton, Pennsylvania, Reading, Pennsylvania as well, two of the three of the biggest up-and-coming cities in the Eastern Seaboard, they were beautiful neighborhoods, and their crime rates went sky high, and it turns out that not every single person, but the majority of people that moved there were from either one of the five boroughs or from Newark, East Orange, Jersey City, Patterson, and Trenton. And they turned a very nice neighborhood into a shithole.
I know Trenton very well and also Patterson. But what I was calling for is you initially called, you said you were having a problem with a concrete slab. And I was going to try to address that for you.
Oh, I would love that. You would make my day, dude.
Well, I got to know what it is.
Well, when the slab was already cracked, when the original American standard was dropped in there, probably in the, I'm going to say the 70s.
Well, American standard used in a bathtub.
Well, no, it was an American standard, but we call it a soot monster.
What was it, a tub?
Those old-fired American standards.
Yeah, a tub.
No, it's a boiler.
A boiler, okay, yeah, all right. So what is this on the base? Hopefully this is on the basement floor, ground level, right?
No, it's basement.
Well, yeah, basement is the ground. So now what? No. So what's going on now?
Well, as soon as we cracked it, it turns out that the original concrete from probably the 1920s or 30s, maybe when this house was built, the concrete around that slab when we pulled the slab out, because the slab was broken into pieces already, it was only about an inch to three quarters of an inch thick. And it's sitting on dirt. And now I got to float a cement floor, and she wants it on a new slab. And I don't know how deep I should go for the cement to hold a boiler.
Well, what square footage is the boiler sitting on? What's the dimensions of the boiler?
Well, the new one's only about, I'm going to say, 200,000 BTU. I'm going to say 2.5 by 2.5 and probably about 3 feet high.
So the new boiler is going to be about the new boiler is going to be about 3 foot square.
Yeah, and but also it weighs about, I'm going to say probably over like 750.
All right, so now you got the old boiler out, and you're taking out the old slab, right?
The old slab was already destroyed. It was destroyed probably when they put the old boiler in the 60s or 70s.
Okay, now let me ask you this question. Now, how many square feet did the old slab take up? In other words, you took out the old slab, and now you're down to dirt, right?
It was a 2x4.
All right, well, okay, now this is what I would do. I would pour a 6-inch slab there, so you have to take some dirt out.
All right, so 6 inches is all you need to do.
6 inch, yeah, pour a 6-inch slab, but around the edges of the slab, you want to dig down, say, maybe an extra 4 inches in order to give yourself a composite footing. You follow what I'm saying? It's like if you went around the edges of the slab and took your a 4-inch cut a 4-inch groove that's about, say, 4 inches deep around the edges of the slab so that when you pour the concrete, it will go down into that groove and act as a perimeter footing, in a makeshift footing.
Like a bottom box.
Yes, it'd be like a muffin pan, or like a it'd be like a muffin pan. Even though it's flat on the top, when you look at it from the side, it goes down. And do you have access to some concrete reinforcement rods that you can get from Home Depot?
No, I'm just pouring in the straight dirt.
Well, you want to keep that slab from cracking again.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm asking about how to do it right. I don't know. We were talking about race relations. I don't even think I'm even interested in this no more.
A six inch slab should be okay to hold your boiler.
Six below the level, and then about another 4 up for a pedestal.
No, not a pedestal. What you're doing? I guess you can call it a slab, but what you're doing, you are putting a footing for that slab to rest on, but it's going to be incorporated with the slab. You follow me?
All right. Yeah, and then I just got to box it out with 2x4s, just pour a little bit. Now, should I use sand mix or just straight stone?
Well, you use one part sand, one part cement, or should I say one part aggregate and one part cement, then you want to keep the water as dry as you can.
Yeah, well, sounds like a good idea. I like it. As long as 6 inches, I'll go 6 inches deep.
Get the dimensions of the 6 inches and turn it into cubic yards. And go to the hardware store and tell them how many cubic yards, and they'll tell you how many bags of cement.
I got 38 bags of cement in my truck. I do a lot of oil work up here. We still have oil heat.
All right, well, you can mix that by hand. Is it pre-mixed?
Oh no, I mix it by hand.
Yeah, well, you can mix it by hand, but a bag of pre-mix would do good. It's got the sand and the rock in it and the cement.
Yeah, I don't trust that shit stuff too much. Like, I don't trust chimney cement.
It's nothing wrong with it. Look, concrete is nothing but sand and rock anyway, and the cement just holds those two ingredients together. That's all it does. But that should work fine for you.
I appreciate it. I'll go six inches then. 4 inches for the slab. I'll box it out with a couple of 2x4s.
No, wait a minute. Hang on.
She wants a new slab, man. That's her business. She's paying me.
Well, the pad you pouring is going to blend into the surface of the other concrete.
I'm going to wait until the floor is dry. It's summertime now. She don't need the boiler right now. I'm going to wait until that floor is dry, and then I'll come back next week and pop off a new slab.
Yeah, that'll work.
Yeah, I figured that would be the best way to go. Mm-hmm. At least keep her happy. It's going to cost me a little, you know, an extra couple bucks, but as long as she's happy and she's and her check clears,
and
that's
really,
pretty
you know,
much
you
all
know,
I'm
really,
about.
And really, you know, as I begin to think about it, 6 inches can, 6 inches is all right, but you can probably get by with 4-inch slab there too. Okay.
On straight dirt, there's no rock not underneath. It's straight dirt.
You can get by with it. I had in the house I built a 4,000 square foot home, and I done my footings over the thick was 2 foot wide, and 1 foot thick. My walls was 10 inches thick, concrete walls for the basement and everything. Now I had a Yukon gas wood gas furnace. 110,000 BTUs. Now, this Yukon is about 5 foot long and about, I'd say, at least 30 inches wide. I set it on a 4-inch slab, like what you want to do with
slab,
that boiler.
I told her I'd put the new boiler on block. Take a concrete block. I'll build a solid slab. Solid, you know, put them all together easy. That's 8 block. She says, nope.
Yeah, you can do that too, but you gotta be able to set those blocks on something that's gonna be the whole thing.
I gotta be honest with you. Tell me if I'm gonna be a scumbag, and I want the host of the show to let me know afterwards. Would I be a scumbag if I just threw up that block in there and just gave it a skim coat?
Well, yeah, but that causes problems in the long run. And then again, it might not. Heck, you just got a boiler. A boiler doesn't do no shaking like a furnace.
She's 67 years old. That goddamn thing ain't going to crack until she's long gone.
Yeah, well, you might be able to get away with it. It's up to you. I just try to give some advice. That's all.
Nah, I'm going to do the right job. I appreciate your input, brother.
All righty.
God bless you, dude.
Same to you, sir.
All right. Well,
nice guy. What a nice guy.
We're going to thank you, Pianki, for offering that invaluable advice, or very valuable advice, I should say. On that note, we're going to cut it out early today. Thank you, caller, for calling in. Thank you for listeners for listening in. And everybody have a good rest of the day and a safe weekend.
Hey, listen, buddy. I need you.